back to the Crit Medic Podcast, where we bring together the worlds of critical care and pre-hospital care. I'm your host, Dominic Wallenzak. This week, we've got a sweet podcast for you, and I'm not even going to sugarcoat it. We're going to talk about cardiac arrest, the most critical condition a patient can possibly be in, though potentially also the most stable. Medicine goes through a lot of effort to reverse cardiac arrest and, essentially, bring people back to life. It doesn't happen often. Survival with good neurologic outcomes happens to only 8.3% of patients in the United States. But when we as providers get to experience ROSC and ultimate survival, it's such a sweet, sweet victory. Speaking of sweet, what about hypoglycemic cardiac arrest? What do we do with these patients? There seems to be some confusion, even among the expert-level physicians. Heck, the American Heart Association has been adding and removing hypoglycemia as one of the H's and T's wordlessly over the past couple revisions, in what I could only imagine to be some internal dispute and uncertainty on the topic within the hallowed halls of the AHA and ECC. So, as you can surmise, this podcast is going to be dedicated to the use of dextrose in cardiac arrest. Should we, or shouldn't we? What do you think? We'll go beyond to explain cardiac anatomy and how it generates the energy it needs to function, and also look at glucometry. Is it even accurate in cardiac arrest? So let's start with the easiest first, glucometry. Technology has come a long way in terms of accuracy, speed, and ease of use from the old chem strips of days gone by. The glucometer at my agency takes 5 seconds to get a reading. A glucometer at another service takes 10 seconds. 10 seconds? But I want it now! I guess modern medicine has spoiled me to the point where I'm too impatient to wait 10 seconds for results. Anyways, despite all the technological advances with point-of-care glucometry, there's still one thing it cannot overcome, and that is sampling. If the sample collected is flawed, then the result that that sample gives is flawed as well. Garbage in, garbage out. And there are a couple ways we can get a flawed result. For instance, excessive milking of the capillary stick site could introduce lymphatic fluid into the specimen, resulting in inaccuracy. But that pales in comparison to the inaccuracy of glucometry in capillary samples in the cardiac arrest or critically hypotensive patients. In fact, let me quote you the conclusion from a study that appears in the Annals of Internal Medicine. Fingerstick glucose testing does not accurately represent venous glucose levels in severely hypotensive patients. If fingerstick glucose testing is relied on for these patients, errors in clinical management may be made. Venous reagent strip glucose testing correlates well with laboratory glucose measurements and should therefore be the preferred method for rapid assessment of glucose levels in critically ill patients with severe hypotension. Why is that? Well, in severe states of shock, the precapillary sphincters cut off flow of blood to the surface of the skin and other distal non-essential areas to keep the core alive. That's why capillary refill time may be severely delayed in these patients, and they may appear pale or ashen. The blood that is in the capillary beds may be sitting there for a period of time without going back into central circulation. During this time, the cells surrounding these capillary beds continue doing what they do, taking glucose for fuel and offloading lactate and other byproducts of anaerobic metabolism. So that means as the capillary blood sits there, it has been continuously drained of the glucose that it carries. Johnny Q paramedic comes along and does a finger stick, the blood glucose concentration is going to be low, lower than the actual concentration of circulating blood. Venous sampling may be an alternative. Despite the fact that most glucometers aren't equipped with venous reagent strips, a capillary reagent strip with a venous sample does generally provide a reasonable estimate of venous blood glucose, but not always. There is an extra measure of inaccuracy that's included. So in hypoperfusion, capillary blood glucose is not a great option. And who has greater hypoperfusion than people in cardiac arrest? In fact, estimates put cardiac perfusion, your number one organ, at anywhere from 10 to 30% of normal circulation in cardiac arrest with CPR. How well do you think your distal vasculature is perfused? Probably not as good. If only I had a study to show that glucometry was not accurate in cardiac arrest. Oh wait, I do. A study showed that the sensitivity of a finger stick in cardiac arrest was 75%, while the specificity was an abysmal 38%. Go ahead and take a look down in the show notes. So, We probably don't have an accurate, reliable means for measuring true systemic blood glucose in a cardiac arrest. But let's look beyond the technical aspect. Is dextrose actually beneficial in a cardiac arrest? Before we can answer that, we have to review cardiac physiology. Because even though I understood the outcome of the science, I had a hard time internalizing exactly how it relates to physiology. Glucose is the most abundant sugar molecule that we have systemically. Other than pathophysiologies like diabetes, glucose is one that can be relied upon to be closely regulated at a stable level thanks to homeostasis. It is used in the Krebs cycle in conjunction with oxygen to synthesize ATP, the primary fuel for the cell. Why don't we just have ATP floating around loose in our bloodstream? Cut out the whole middleman of glucose, the hassle of having to try and convert it in the first place. Well, you see, ATP is like liquid energy. It is a catalyst for many functions and reactions throughout the body. Having it float around the bloodstream, free to cause whatever reaction it happens to encounter, would cause physiologic chaos. Oh, and death. It would be like having gasoline just poured onto the roads to fuel cars. For that reason, the body tightly regulates ATP. But glucose isn't the only fuel out there. There are also long-chain fatty acids, carbohydrate, ketone bodies, lactate. In fact, as far as energy conversion and density, glucose isn't really that great. So then, why does our brain use it? Well, it's because the fatty acids are usually albumin-bound and don't cross the blood-brain barrier. So it has to rely on glucose instead. How much of the myocardial ATP is generated from glucose? Well, according to a study by Dr. Kobayashi, only about 4%. In ischemic tissues, this can increase to 20%. But this is not a desired result. Studies have suggested that having a higher blood glucose level during periods of ischemia increases anaerobic metabolism, promotes the conversion of pyruvate into lactate, and causes intracellular acidosis and may decrease cerebral blood flow, exacerbating cerebral ischemic injury. We also know from studies that it's not only 50% dextrose that can cause these issues. Even the amount of dextrose in D5W or D5 lactated ringers was enough to worsen outcomes in canine studies dating back to the 80s. So we've known this for years, decades even. Speaking of which, in 1990, the Annals of Emergency Medicine had an article in which they concluded that empiric glucose, quote, should be avoided in patients at risk for cerebral ischemia, such as those with acute stroke, impending cardiac arrest, severe hypotension, or receiving CPR. Later on, in 1997, the Journal of Cerebral Blood Flow and Metabolism had an article that concluded, quote, high blood glucose concentrations occurring over the first 24 hours after cardiac arrest have deleterious effects on function and neurological recovery. I could sit here and quote all kinds of studies that put another nail in the coffin of the myth of dextrose and cardiac arrest, but these are all small fries. Let's talk about the big one. The one that I think put the coffin in the grave. In April 2015, Critical Care published a study by Peng et al. This study was the largest human study to date on the use and outcomes of dextrose on in-hospital cardiac arrest. It enrolled over 100,000 patients in cardiac arrest. They found that dextrose was associated with a significantly decreased chance of survival to discharge and a decreased chance of good neurologic outcomes. They also found that the association between dextrose administration and ROSC was not significant when the propensity-matched analysis was used. In short, the largest human study to date found worse survival and worse neurologic outcomes, and no change in ROSC. All things considered, when you couple that with an understanding of cardiac physiology, showing that glucose really is far down the list of desired sources for ATP, as well as our overall inability to accurately get glucose readings in these patients, the picture is pretty stark. We should not be using dextrose at all in cardiac arrests, even with the knowledge that they are hypoglycemic, which we don't accurately have either. But I would be remiss if I did not at least mention some of the supporting evidence. If you're familiar with my teardown of the Sabolt and Naloxone study, this supporting evidence makes Dr. Sable's study look actually pretty good. So apparently different committees write the adult ACLS and the PALS guidelines. Because when it comes to dextrose, the AHA removed hypoglycemia wordlessly and never looked back. It's probably an embarrassing episode for them that they let hypoglycemia be added to the H's and T's in 2005 without evidence. So they're pretty mum on the matter. However, here's what Powell says. Because infants have relatively high glucose requirements and low glycogen stores, they may develop hypoglycemia when energy requirements rise. Check blood glucose concentration during the resuscitation and treat hypoglycemia promptly. Class 1, level of evidence C. Class 1, eh? That's like super important, right up there with defibrillation and CPR. But wait, how did it make it as a class 1 with a C level of evidence? As a reminder, C means that there's some supporting evidence out there, but there's some issues. And the evidence that they use points to a 1999 study by Dr. Losek. Let's take a critical look at this. First of all, the recommendations in the study use the term resuscitation. It's important to keep in mind that they broadly define resuscitation as altered consciousness, status epilepticus, respiratory failure, cardiac failure, and cardiopulmonary arrest. To that extent, using dextrose for altered consciousness, seizures, or respiratory failure in the context of hypoglycemia is entirely reasonable. I resuscitate people from altered level of consciousness with dextrose on a weekly basis. We must keep in mind that the purpose of the study was to determine the prevalence of hypoglycemia and to describe the clinical variables associated with hypoglycemia in seriously ill children, as well as the detection of hypoglycemia. Nothing more. It is inadequately powered to and not designed to determine the morbidity and mortality benefit of administration of dextrose in the context of cardiac arrest. The study looked at 49 patients who received resuscitative care. Specifically, 10 with altered consciousness, 29 with status epilepticus, 24 with non-asystolic respiratory failure, 6 with non-asystolic cardiac failure, and 6 with cardiopulmonary arrest. 27 patients had more than one disorder. Of those 49 patients, only 9 were found to be hypoglycemic in the emergency department. Of those 9 patients, only 1 patient presented in cardiopulmonary arrest. 4 others ended up dying later of septic shock. And that one patient who was in cardiopulmonary arrest? He was a 10-year-old male who came in for static anoxic encephalopathy, secondary to strangulation, in cardiac arrest. And his glucose? Well, point-of-care blood glucose was 31 milligrams per deciliter. The lab serum glucose levels came back later, and he was actually 61 milligrams per deciliter. Technically, not hypoglycemic. But they gave D25 anyways. And the end result? Well, he died. So, we have one patient who was not hypoglycemic, who got dextrose, who didn't even survive, in a study not designed to assess the effectiveness of dextrose in cardiac arrest, being used as the entire basis of a belief system on giving dextrose in cardiac arrest, in the face of all the other evidence showing that dextrose in arrest is bad. So we have two ways that we can interpret this. If we interpret the PALS guidelines on dextrose in resuscitation to mean specifically cardiopulmonary arrest resuscitation, we have to conclude that the AHA is comprised of morons that don't understand data and think anecdote, and not even a good one at that, is the best evidence. Well, the AHA may be a lot of things. They may be slow at times to adapt and change core aspects of care, but they are not morons. So therefore, just like the study cited as evidence, we must conclude that they mean resuscitation in the general term, including various patients in extremis and altered levels of consciousness. And to that extent, the recommendation of dextrose in general, specifically non-cardiac arrest, resuscitation makes sense. So let's tie it all together with a simple bullet list. Myocardial cells don't use glucose as a primary source of fuel. As little as 4% of myocardial ATP is generated from glucose. Giving dextrose during periods of ischemia increases anaerobic metabolism, promotes conversion of pyruvate into lactate, causes intracellular acidosis, and may decrease cerebral blood flow and exacerbate cerebral ischemic injury. We can't accurately determine blood glucose in cardiac arrest using capillary blood glucose. and glucometer using a venous sample without a venous reagent strip is suspect and potentially inaccurate. The largest study to date shows worse overall survival to discharge. The largest study also shows worse neurologic outcomes. And the largest study shows no association between dextrose and ROSC when propensity-matched analysis is used. Studies show that even as little as 5% dextrose can worsen outcomes in cardiac arrest. So we have no physiologic mechanism by which it can work, but we do have one by which it can cause harm. The evidence doesn't show any improvement, but it does show worse outcomes. And we can't even measure it in cardiac arrest accurately anyways. Is that about the gist of it? I think it is. So that covers giving dextrose during arrest. But what about pre-arrest? Can hypoglycemia cause cardiac arrest? Well, yes and no. Hypoglycemia can lead to some EKG changes such as QT prolongation and increased ectopy, likely due to catecholamine response. Sometimes that combination can precipitate arrest. Or the cardiac arrest is sometimes secondary to myocardial ischemia from severe hypoventilation and hypoxia. This type of arrest is mainly secondary to autonomic activation, principally of the sympathetic adrenal system, which results in hemodynamic changes, vasoconstriction, and rise in intravascular coagulability and viscosity. Not to mention, diabetes is a major risk factor for cardiovascular disease, so these hearts are often less healthy to begin with. Inflammatory cytokines and endothelial dysfunction could potentially be aggravating factors that contribute to increased cardiovascular risk with severe hypoglycemia. Unsurprisingly, in younger patients with type 1 diabetes, despite having higher instances of nocturnal hypoglycemia, occurrences of sudden nocturnal death from hypoglycemia are rare. And those that did die were found to have irreversible hypoglycemic brain damage anyways, which tells us two things. One, hypoglycemia is rarely a direct cause of death, but often a contributing factor to an arrest mediated primarily through heart disease. And two, those who arrest not from primary heart disease have already sustained a severe hypoglycemic brain injury that is often irrecoverable. Now let's take a look at the post-arrest period. Once we reestablish effective perfusion and spontaneous circulation, as well as reaching appropriate oxygen saturation, we could likely evaluate the patient's blood glucose levels. The catecholamine response often results in post-arrest increase in plasma glucose concentrations, and this mechanism is not solely limited to releasing glycogen stores either. Studies have shown that the longer the duration of CPR, the higher the likely post-arrest glucose will be. Once we get ROSC, we'll have an improved perfusion, so we'll have an actually accurate means to measure blood glucose. And then, since the brain is, hopefully, no longer in an ischemic state, there is a reduced likelihood of poor outcomes with dextrose administration. In fact, one study showed a significant increase in mortality in the upper and lower quartile of blood glucose readings in both hypo and hyperglycemic post-arrest patients. That's why ILCOR's recommendations include a moderate target for glucose control of up to 144 mg per deciliter, or 8 millimoles. So our goal, post-arrest, should be careful management with low-dose, low-concentration glucose to a target of euglycemia. So the best available evidence says don't use dextrose during arrest. But after arrest, careful, controlled administration of dextrose to a target of euglycemia is appropriate. So I think that about covers everything you could want to know about dextrose and cardiac arrest. If your service or your peers are recommending the outdated and deleterious practice of giving dextrose intra-arrest, it is up to you, the informed CritMedic listener, to try and get them to change their ways to be able to deliver the highest possible patient care to your patients. It's amazing. ACLS drops atropine because they couldn't prove benefit, and everyone does so without hesitation. ACLS drops hypoglycemia from the H's and T's because the risk and harm is greater than the benefit, and yet everyone clings to this outdated practice. This myth of dextrose and cardiac arrest seems to be fairly widespread. In an informal poll on the Paramedics on Facebook group, the number of people who would give dextrose in cardiac arrest outnumber the people who say not to by about a 5-to-1 ratio, so there's a lot of education to spread around. I'm not alone in my quest for not using dextrose in cardiac arrest. Brooks Walsh at Mill Hill Avenue Command did a fantastic write-up on this in 2012, and Tim Noonan at Rogue Medic did the same in 2015. I'd recommend you scroll down to the bottom of the show notes and take a moment to read their material too, because it's very well done. But I've prattled on for too long. That's all the time we have for this episode. I hope you join us next time on the Crit Medic Podcast. Until then, folks, stay sweet and keep thinking differently.